activate the view screen, and turn on your universal translators, because it is time for another Galactic Netcast.
We interrupt this program to give you a bulletin just received from one of our naval units at sea. A large object traveling at supersonic speed is headed over the North Atlantic toward the east coast of the United States.
This Earth of yours will be reduced to a burned-out cinder.
This could be the beginning of the end for the human race. Human beings cower before the onslaught of these unearthly enemies.
It is Thursday, June 11th, 2014. Welcome to another Galactic Netcast. We are live! This is the Alien Invasion number 107 in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. I'm Mr. Dave Nelson. Joining me, as always, my sidekicks, my cohorts, my co-hosts, Brad Ludwig and Nessa Moyens, both in Wausau, Wisconsin. How you guys doing?
Awesome!
Slightly phlegmy, but otherwise good.
You were doing some grass mowing there, Nessa, right?
Yes.
Did you run into any aliens out there?
No, but I did come across a toad.
Oh, you didn't run him over, did you?
No, he hopped away.
Oh, that's not, you don't want to do that. I ran over a frog one time, and I felt so bad.
Oh, no, I probably would have stood there and started crying. but no, I was mowing, and I was getting kind of close to tall grass, and I guess he heard me coming, and he just, like, hopped across the patio. So I'm like, okay, you go over there and hang out. I'll mow over here. It'll be fine.
He's a smart toad.
Yep.
All right, so grass is mowed. Brad, you got anything to report?
No.
No?
I got nothing.
Okay.
Nothing, nothing new and or exciting. No.
He provided dinner. It's all good.
Well, good thing we brought some things to talk about. This is the show where we talk about beings from elsewhere in the universe and their appearances in film, TV, video games, comic books, science, real life. I could go on, actually. It's all about aliens, and the show is divided into three sections. The news, the craft corner, that's our spotlight of a certain kind of alien spacecraft, and our picks for the week. And we'd like to encourage you to come watch us live every week as we record the show, Wednesdays normally at 7 Central, 8 Eastern Time on Google. Just follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or Google Plus. Find out when that's going to be, and we'll post a link and that kind of stuff. Also, watch us later on YouTube at Galactic or YouTube.com/GalacticNetcast. Also, one more thing. Patreon campaign continues. You can support the show financially with only a dollar a month. That's like a soda, a pop, however you want to pronounce it. Go to Patreon.com/GalacticNetcasts. And for as little as $1 a month, you can become our boss. You can tell us what to do. You know, you get that dollar a month gives you the right to tell us what to do. So again, Patreon.com/GalacticNetcasts. And we thank you for your support.
I'll tell you what to do.
I would like to buy a Coke.
You know, you could be like, who's your daddy? I'm your daddy. I gave you that dollar a month, so.
No, I don't even want to remotely do that. That's icky and weird. I like you, Dave Nelson, but I don't like you like that.
Okay, I don't like you like that either. I'm just saying, I'm just throwing out all kinds of possibilities.
Oh, okay.
That's just one possibility among many, many, many others.
Okay.
All right, so with that said, let's get the show on the road and talk about stuff here. Oh, no.
There we go.
In the news.
And the news begins with Brad's story. What do you got, Brad?
It does, and it comes to us from the fine folks at IO9. They put together a great story about the most extreme environments where alien life could be found. So this article is based on some information that NASA space scientist Christopher P. McKay put together. And basically, it's a list of specific parameters. Now, this is based on human life, the things that we need to – or the things that the life on Earth has needed to grow, thrive, and exist. So like bare minimums, okay? And because that's all we know, that's really all that we can kind of project onto alien life. So you put together this checklist, and we're going to go over it briefly here. One, it needs to be within a certain specific temperature range. Okay. Obviously, we couldn't exist in a bed of lava, nor could we exist without a lot of help in the Arctic. So there's a definite temperature range in which life comfortably can exist and thrive in.
Okay, I want to bring something up. What if this life form has a natural built-in, like, shielding, like some kind of thing that surrounds their body, protects them from extreme temperatures?
How extreme are we talking about?
Do they have superpowers, Dave Nelson? Is that what you're asking me?
Yeah, no. I mean, that's just no. One possibility.
Okay. Basically, this is based off of, since no human being or animal that we know of has superpowers or mutants or have metagenes if you're in the DC universe, these are going to be the lists. You have to go back with this list with all these caveats. Damn it, Dave Nelson.
Sorry. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. So, no projected force fields like, what was her name? Skids from the Marvel Universe. So you're going to make me pull out some character names here. That's what I'm going to do now.
No, pull them out. Go ahead.
That's what she said. So the second item is going to be the availability of water. Life on Earth needs water. Now, it doesn't need to be like swimming in the ocean necessarily, but there needs to be some form of water at which carbon life as we know it, needs at some level. There needs to be some kind of water. Access to energy. Now, that energy is like sunlight. That energy is not necessarily that they have to be able to manufacture power by burning coal or some other. That's not what this is about. This is just energy. We need sun to exist, for plants to generate chlorophyll, to generate the energy and the food that they need. They need energy from the sun. That's what that's what this item is about. Not too much UV or other forms of radiation. We obviously can't exist on the surface of Mars or the moon for long periods of time without some kind of shielding. It's not natively habitable by human beings.
Or
so again,
a force field.
It needs to be within a certain range.
A force field.
Yes, or a force field. Exactly. Like Reflecto from the Legion of Superheroes.
I challenge you,
who
Brad
actually Lewis. turned out to be Superboy. So there you go. Boom. You challenge? I'm sorry.
I challenge you to think of as many superheroes that have like some kind of reflecting beam or some kind of force field during this story. I challenge you.
Well, there's Reflecto from Legion of Superheroes. There's Skids, who was a part of X-Force New Mutants and became evil. She's on X-Factors, first introduced in X-Factor. Yeah, those are the only two that come to mind right now.
Okay,
moving on. Nitrogen requirements. Oddly enough, human beings need nitrogen. Life on Earth needs nitrogen. Our atmosphere has nitrogen in it.
Yep.
And oxygen requirements. Plants absorb CO2, which is carbon dioxide, oxygen, and exude oxygen, which we exude, expel, exhale. Oxygen for us to breathe.
And even like extremophiles, like the life on the very, very depths of the ocean or very, very thin atmosphere, they still need some kind of oxygen, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Maybe they consume less or more, but they still consume it. They still need it. Now, just like the English language has an I before E, except after C, just as an A, as a neighbor or way, there are exceptions to these rules, and the exception would actually most likely be found on Titan, which is the moon of Saturn. Titan has an atmosphere, and we are looking to explore Titan, and if we actually find microbial life or any kind of life on Titan, the liquid that's on the planet is ethane and methane, if I recall correctly, not water. So, I mean, if we find any kind of life on there, they would not apply to these rules, which means that the set of rules I just went over would be complete crap and we'd have to redo the whole thing.
So what we need to do is start, like, exploring our own, like, nearby solar system to find out if these rules are, you know, cut and dry or they can be bent a little bit.
Correct. And I know that we are planning I know that they've worked out some of the engineering bits, but they're looking to actually drill through, I think it was Titan, and they're looking to like put a submersible, like a robotic submersible, to kind of investigate the liquid that's frozen underneath, or I'm sorry, the liquid that's underneath the frozen crust, to see if there is life there.
And so, also, what's the Jupiter? What's the moon?
Is it Io?
No, not Io.
Europa?
Europa. Thank
Europa.
You. Yeah,
thank
I think
you.
They're thinking about doing that on Europa as well.
Yep. So, I'm sorry. Europa is the one that they're going to be burrowing through and putting the submarine in. Titan is a solid surface that doesn't have, like I said, the liquid that's on it is ethane methane.
Okay.
Yes. Okay.
So many different,
slightly confusing, but there you go.
So many different moons. Hard to keep track of them all. So we understand.
A couple tree. Yep. Or no.
Question for you guys. So I know here on Earth we have the funky looking little creature called the tardigrade. Do you think we might find something similar when looking for life, like on one of our moons?
Can you describe what is that? I've never heard of that.
They call them the water bear, but they're like these tiny, tiny, tiny little critters. And they're very hardcore in that they can survive really extreme temperature ranges from like negative 450 something degrees to like almost 400 degrees Fahrenheit. And they can withstand a certain amount of radiation, and they can survive being in space, and they can live a couple hundred years.
Wow.
Yeah. So like
they can be freeze-dried and then be thawed and be like, oh, hey, I'm just going to float around here in the water and look oddly adorable yet ugly all at the same time.
So the concept of panspermia, the thought there is these creatures could have actually been sent to us by another planet. Had there, like, if there was a collision on Mars, if there actually would have been life on Mars, and these creatures would have been there, and there would have been an asteroid collision, and there was an ejection of material that would have hit the Earth, they would have survived that traveling through space without water, without protection from the intense cold, without protection from the intense radiation. They would have survived reentry.
No, that's very interesting.
So
I was going to do a screen share, but I'm failing. I did the screen capture thing.
I was wondering. All right, I'm like, no one's ever done that before. That's weird. Okay. Okay.
That's just me messing around. Yeah. Did it? Am I
sure? Oh, I've seen okay, those guys. I've seen this guy before.
So these are some of the. There's a good picture of the tardigrade. There's like 900 species of tardigrades.
He's cute.
Yeah, I'm like, he's kind of ugly yet cute at the same time.
Kind of like bats. They're cute until they open their wings. And then you're like, ugh.
Yeah. But they just kind of like hang out and crawl through the water. And I don't know how else to describe the tardigrade aside if no one's ever seen him. They call him a water bear, so you can kind of think that he's kind of big and bulky looking. And it's got, what, 8 limbs? And it kind of reminds me of wearing some sort of space suit or hazmat suit.
Yeah, he does look like.
And where the face would be, it looks to me kind of like a respirator type thing on a gas mask almost. But you don't see any eyes or anything. It's just all kind of caves in there. And it's really weird looking, but yeah, oddly cute at the same time.
Are they microscopic or are they like just really, really small?
I think they're microscopic.
They are microscopic. Okay. They've actually appeared quite a bit on Cosmos.
Yeah, they have.
Oh, I remember seeing them. Yeah. Do we know how long they've been on the planet?
I don't know. They've, I don't know, but they've probably been here for a really, really, really long time.
So if any creature...
I don't know if this particular article says anything, but... I'm sure they've been here for a long time, and seeing how hardy they are and can survive being freeze-dried for a while and come back and they're, hey, back to life, then, yeah, they're going to be around for quite a while.
So these guys are the best candidate for some kind of panspermia from a different planet type deal, I'm guessing.
Yeah, because it says that they can be freeze-dried and still survive 200 years later. So,
wow. I'd like to be freeze-dried and woken back up. That'd be cool.
Might be really groggy afterwards.
I need some coffee. Give me some coffee.
Give me some water. I need some more shoes.
They've found tardigrades. It is an ancient group with fossils dating back from 530 million years ago, so in the Cambrian period. So they've been around for a half a billion years.
Holy crap.
At least.
Wow. Okay. All right.
That's crazy.
That's neat. Well, okay, I wanted to bring something up real quick. Okay, whenever they discover a new planet, whenever astronomers discover a new planet, what's the thing in space? Kepler. Okay.
Kepler?
As soon as when Kepler discovers a new planet, do you think there's one person like on the team that tries to figure out if life could survive on that type of planet, the particular one they found?
I'm sure, because, I mean, you've got a group of people that basically try to find planets, period. So they try to locate a planet, confirm that it is a planet, and then once they get that information out, then I'm sure there's another group of people that are like, okay, let's take a look at these specific qualifications and take a look at the spectroscopy that we're getting back, the spectrum that's being reflected from this planet, and see if any of the elements would be any of the ones that we would consider basics for life.
Of course, it's got to be within a certain amount of distance from whatever star is in that galaxy.
Right. And you're looking at, as they describe for Earth, we're in the Goldilocks zone. We're not too far out, but we're not too close. So you end up with Venus, which is too close. Bad things happen in its past, and now it's suffering from a runaway greenhouse effect. And then you have Mars, a bit too far out, and it's just a barren rock for the most part with, you know, polar caps. But there's not a whole lot going on as far as we know. So
now those planets, they, like Mars, supposedly used to have life. Or it's a possibility that Mars used to have life. Is it because the sun was hotter at one point? And the same goes for Venus. The sun was maybe cooler at one point? Or why do you think these – I know I'm going on a whole bunch of different rants here, but or different roads here. But what conditions in the solar system was able to give those planets life if they had life at one time?
If it wouldn't be so much that the sun was hotter or the sun was cooler, but it would be more of
geological
during its formation, during the formation of the planet. There are certain events that end up taking place, and it might have been at one point that Mars did have more of an atmosphere and it did have oceans and, who knows, potentially even life, but at the very least it had oceans, let's say. And then Venus could have been in a similar boat. It had, you know, oceans and whatnot as well. But then you also are still going through the formation period, and there's a lot of debris flying around. And so once they start getting impacted with the debris, like it could set off chain reactions and whatnot, that would cause for Venus, it would have basically, I don't remember. They talked about it on Cosmos too.
Oh, by the way, speaking of that, Cosmos available on DVD and Blu-ray today. So go out and...
Oh, wow, that was quick.
Hands on that thing.
They weren't messing around.
No.
Yeah, they weren't. But no, I mean, for one thing, Venus is revolving in the opposite direction that we are, and its days are, like, what, longer than its year or something ridiculous like that? And so not only do you have, like, basically you have Venus that got bombarded with a bunch of stuff, and it kicked a bunch of stuff up into the atmosphere, including maybe methane from volcanic activity. And any little bit of heat that or sunlight that could actually make it through the atmosphere heated up, like the clouds of methane and whatnot, kept that energy in. Whereas the Earth, we have cloud cover, but if you notice whenever it's clear at night, especially during the winter, you end up with radiational cooling where all the heat escapes. For Venus, it doesn't have that. And so since it can't escape, it just gets hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter.
Okay.
So.
All right.
And so now you have Venus as we know it today, and we've sent probes, well, the Russians and whatnot, but they haven't really survived for very long. I think the last one that they sent survived for a couple of hours. Most of what we know about the surface has been done through basically radar, sonar, whatever technology, taking images that way, and just getting the images from the reflections that we send down to Venus. And that's how we're able to map its surface. As for Mars, it could have just been too far out and didn't receive enough heat, and the core probably cooled a bit quicker too than, say, Earth's is, or if it is indeed cooling, I don't know. But yeah, I think it just was a bit too far out, and the conditions weren't quite right, and it just kind of went kaput.
Too far out, man. Okay.
Yep.
All right. Great story, Brad. Thank you very much.
I could totally be wrong, though. So if anybody wants to, like, correct me, they're more than welcome to.
You could totally be what? Wrong?
No, I could totally be wrong. I'm just saying.
Okay.
Not perfect.
Nobody is. All right. So let's move on to or from science to science fiction. And Edward James Olmos, did you know that he agreed to do Battlestar Galactica only if he was promised that there would be no aliens on the show? Did you guys know that?
I did, because I saw that story, and then I saw that you took it.
Well, I mean, you could have lied, Anessa.
I'm sorry. No, I had no idea, Dave. Tell us more.
Hermagerd!
Of course you know about it, because you're looking at the same doc as I am. Okay.
I'm still looking at the tardigrade, so it's okay.
It's an interesting story. This comes out from the recent opening of a new museum exhibit. There is the Experience Music and Science Fiction Museum in Seattle. I had no idea that the Experience Museum now had science fiction exhibits, but it does. That's the Experience is based on Jimi Hendrix and the Experience from Seattle. Apparently, they've got a wing for science fiction. And they have an exhibit now that kind of commemorates and honors the 10th anniversary, 10 years since Battlestar Galactica first hit the airwaves, the reimagined version of it on Sci-Fi. So Olmos despises cliches, and he was worried while being courted for the series that they would be like other sci-fi shows and feature low-budget, rubber-faced aliens. So to make sure that the new version of Battlestar Galactica didn't turn into a Creature of the Week show, which the original one did kind of, sort of, not really, but they had a few episodes with weird aliens, he had an anti-alien clause tacked onto his agreement to play Admiral Adama. And here's an excerpt from his comments. And he said, "The first four-eyed monster that I see, I'm going to faint on camera. Then I'm going to get up, and you're going to have to write me out of the show."
I can see him saying that.
Yeah.
And I can hear him saying that in my head.
Do you hear him as Edward James Olmos, or do you hear him as Admiral Adama?
Ooh. And random semi-related note to Edward James Olmos, but if ever you go to a convention and he is there and he has a panel and you decide to address him as they give you the option to ask a question, make sure you address the guy as Mr. Olmos.
Really? Does he correct you if you don't?
Yes.
Really? That's interesting.
Because someone, I think, called him Edward or Eddie or something. He's like, Mr. Olmos.
Wow.
Yeah.
Holy crap. I had no idea he was that way. Okay.
I was like, sir, yes, sir.
Well, I guess he won like an Academy Award, right? For Stand By Me. What was that movie? He was the teacher. He was Stand and Deliver. No, that's not it. Something Stand. Standing something. Standing Hampton? No.
No. Standing Hampton?
It's Stand and Deliver, isn't it?
I don't know. Yeah, that's probably it. So maybe he feels like he needs to be respected that way. I don't know.
I think maybe he's just old school in some of his customs. And it's like, if you don't know me and we're not pals and I'm older, then you should respect me and you should address me my Mr. Olmos until you actually know me personally.
Okay.
And it's cool to call me Ed or Eddie.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
I don't know. That's how I see the guy. I could totally be wrong.
Okay. Well, he seems like a real stand-up guy. Like, he seems like he's very, I don't know. He seems like whatever he does, be it science fiction or a drama, you know, some kind of very dramatic movie or Miami Vice, he seems to take all of his roles very seriously. And he represents those genres very well whenever he has to, whenever he, you know. So I have a lot of respect for that kind of person.
He's won a couple of Golden Globes, one for Miami Vice, one for The Burning Season. He was nominated for Best Actor for Stand and Deliver. He was also nominated for a Golden Globe for Stand and Deliver. He won a... Yep, those are at least for those awards.
So no Academy Awards.
No, he has not won any Oscars at this time.
All right. Okay, so it went on to say, this story went on to say that maybe it wasn't just him, because producer Ronald D. Moore probably had something to do with it as well. He recently told journalists at this opening of this exhibit that he aimed to keep the focus on the characters and their struggles rather than cool gadgetry and strange aliens, probably in part because of his experience as the writer and producer for Star Trek shows for a lot of years before Battlestar Galactica. So I could, and I think I've heard him in other interviews say that he wanted to go, you know, the complete opposite. You know, shiny, reflective panels, and everything's clean to something dirty. So I could see, you know, doing the opposite with the aliens too, because Star Trek is pretty much all they do is aliens, right, for the most part. And the show, Battlestar Galactica, was alien-free, except for, you know, if you consider the Cylons aliens, they're sort of like aliens.
Sort of.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Remember, you guys, have you guys, either of you, watched the original Battlestar Galactica?
Oh, yeah.
I have not.
The pilot, the original movie, when they were down on the planet, that casino planet,
mm-hmm.
and the singers and the girls in the girl group, and they like had double faces or triple faces.
And they could sing harmonies with themselves. It was very creepy.
Yeah, and it's really bad.
It sounds like it.
Yeah, and then there were some other aliens involved as well, so I could really see why. And then you don't want to do a whole, you know, aliens can either be great or turn out really, really bad. And if your focus is on, like, the survivors, you want to keep looking in, not looking out. So I could see why. There are many reasons why you wouldn't want to have aliens on the reimagined Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah. I'm glad they didn't have aliens. It worked out really well.
Yeah, it would be kind of distracting, definitely.
Very much so.
So great insight from Eddie.
From Mr. Almost.
I'm gonna call
Mr. Almost to you, good sir.
I'm going
to
call him Eddie. Until
Miss Jackson, if you're nasty.
I'm going to call him Eddie until he actually finds me, calls me up, or emails me and says, that's Mr. Almost to you. I challenge Eddie to hear our podcast and call me out. Put me in my place, Eddie.
I don't know if he does that for every panel, but he did for the one that they had at the Dallas Comic Con.
Maybe he was just, like, messing with people that day.
Maybe. I don't know. And it's really hard to tell because sometimes his humor can be kind of dry.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't always tell right away if he's joking or not.
Yeah. No, I could see that. I could totally see that. Yeah.
So.
Definitely.
Who knows?
All right. Final story of the show. A follow-up to your story. Yeah, follow-up to your story last week.
Yes. So last week I talked about how the Raelian movement, basically a group of people who claim that they have like 90,000 followers or members of this group throughout the world, they all believe that the alien species called the Elohim are going to come down to Earth, and they've been trying to get Canada and its government involved to build an embassy for aliens so they can visit and conduct extraterrestrial political business. And John Baird, Canada's foreign affairs minister, responded to the group on Thursday, I assume last week, that, he responded to the group with a tweet that...
Because that's how it's done these days.
Kind of funny. So his tweet says, just saw the proposal for a Raelian embassy, an interplanetary hub in Canada. I hereby appoint at Deepak Obrai as intergalactic ambassador. I probably butchered Deepak's name, but Deepak is a Tory MP and Parliament Secretary to the Foreign Affairs Minister. And he provided a swift response back to John Baird saying, accepted.
Nice. Done and done.
So, yeah, the Of course, it mentions, the article mentions that the Raelians applied for tax-exempt status in Canada in the 1990s. The request was refused, just not by Baird's Twitter account, because Twitter didn't exist. So.
Really? Didn't exist back in the 90s? I didn't know that.
Surprise! But, yeah, and it comes from Huffington Post in Canada, so.
Did you know that the Huffington Post actually has a separate page for all their alien-related stories?
Yes.
Okay. Just making sure that you guys knew. I didn't know if you knew or not.
Oh, yeah. I think searching for alien stories, we tend to figure out which sites have what.
Yeah. Yeah, we've been doing this for 107 episodes, so kind of know where the good story, the good stuff is.
We've done a couple tree
for now. Yeah. All right.
Yeah, there's the story. John Baird appoints Deepak as the intergalactic ambassador, and he said accepted.
So he's going to get the ball rolling on this thing, going to get it built?
I doubt it.
You need somebody in the trenches to kick some ass, get it going, get that runway built.
Hey, maybe you could talk to them and be like, I will supervise this project because I'm totally into aliens.
Sure. I'll get right on that because I got nothing better to do. All right. I'm looking forward to the embassy here in Canada. All right.
You'll have to let us know.
Yeah, I will. Definitely.
I wonder if they do tours.
That would be see not you're thinking, Anessa. You're thinking outside the box. You build the embassy not for the aliens necessarily because they may or may not come. You build it for the tourists, and you make it like, you know, you put it like a museum exhibit in there. Like, you put alien facts about aliens that supposedly exist, you know? Because there's a lot of, like UFO sightings and alien encounters in Canada, which I will tell you more about with my pick coming up, by the way.
What?
Little tease.
And I'll tell you about Texas, because we have those too.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, I think they're thinking about this wrong. I think they're thinking this the wrong way. I think they need to think of it as an economic investment in the economy. That's what they need
to do. And that's what part of the Raelian thing was it would be a boost to the economy.
Yes, exactly.
So I think they already kind of had that idea for tourism.
Yeah.
In addition to just being an embassy for beings that may or may not arrive anytime soon?
Well, I mean, an economic boom as far as aliens go, too. You get the humans involved. They're coming to the museum, checking out the landing strip, that kind of thing. And then when the aliens finally get here, it's a commerce. It's like a hub for commerce. They can bring their gold-pressed latinum and trade with us. That'd be awesome.
I wonder what the exchange rate would be.
I don't know. I haven't seen the markets on gold plus press latinum recently. All right.
That's hard to say.
All right. Thank you, Anessa. Thanks for the update. We'll follow the story as it evolves. But right now we have to tell you a way that you can let us know what you think of our show or give us feedback on any of the stuff that we've talked about. You can email us galacticnetcasts@gmail.com, galacticnetcasts@gmail.com. That is the official Galactic Netcast email address. And our official voicemail number is 805-328-3966, 805-328-3966. It's been a while since we had a voicemail. It'd be nice to hear from somebody. Let us know how sucky we are or how great we are. Doesn't matter. We'll take it.
Speaking
both.
Of voicemails.
Yes.
Whatever happened to Peter from Florida?
I know. Come on, Peter. Step it up.
We miss you, Peter.
I got an email from him not too long ago that was like, it seemed like it was a setup for a voicemail that wasn't attached. So I don't know. I don't know what happened.
Weird.
Yeah. So.
Well, if he can call back, that would be awesome.
Yeah. 805.
Message.
Yeah. 805-328-3966. Please call us back, Peter, or anybody else, and leave a message. Just say anything, and we'll play it on the show for you. All right. Here we go. Let's do the old this here right here.
Please identify the craft you witnessed.
A black triangular
three-dimensional shape, huge, just flying, hovering in it.
Shaped like almost like between an egg and like a teardrop.
Two long cylinder objects flying over me.
We had a dome. I could see the occupants in it. It
appeared to be rotating, and it was circular to disc shape, and it hovered for maybe about 5 minutes.
All right, it's time for the Craft Corner, a.k.a. Famous Alien Spacecraft in History, and Brad picked the one for this week. And what do you got for us, Brad?
Well, this week we're going to go with the shape called the chevron or the boomerang shape, and this has been cited numerous times. One of the first recorded ones that we found is at a power plant near Westchester County, New York in 1982. It was called the Westchester Boomerang because the earliest reports came from Westchester County, and it was huge, and it often flew close to the ground, so low that the gray superstructure could be seen often blinking numerous multicolored lights. So, I mean, it was so close to the ground that people could make out some detail out of it. Very, very interesting looking craft. Some other reports, Pound Ridge, New York. Let's see. 12 security guards watched a boomerang-shaped object hover for more than 10 minutes directly above one of the reactors of the Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant. And this was in 1984 in Buchanan, New York.
Ooh, 84, middle of the Cold War. That must have been a tense moment there.
I don't doubt it. Let's see. Another report from somebody else witnessing the same event. It hovered only 300 feet above an active vent at the Indian Point nuclear plant cooling tower for 15 minutes.
Jesus. Wow.
Several guards came forward to report the incident, reporting that there were a total of 11 witnesses to the UFO at the plant that night, and that the security guards broke out shotguns.
Get off my lawn!
Yeah. That's a no-messing-around situation. Well, especially, I mean, it's a nuclear power plant. We're wrapping up the Cold War. Who knows what's going on? That's kind of a serious deal. Let's see. Let's find another one here. Just really fascinating. Here's one from 93 in Canada. Dark gray, black, and triangular or boomerang shape, three dim red lights on it, one near each point of the triangle, so at the sort of the wings and at the nose. Now, the lights were not, according to one witness, points of light like a star, but circles of light.
I've heard these described before, and they sound very much like the triangular UFO as well.
Yeah. Let's see. There was one in 2005 in Kaufman, Texas. I'm trying to find the details on that one. Here we go. A witness states, I was out today taking pictures of the chemtrails. Okay, we're not even going to talk about this one.
Anytime chemtrails are brought up.
Nope.
Woohoo! Crazy.
Nope. Once I see the words chemtrails, I'm out. I'm out. Let's see.
Don't
Here's
play
the, here. 2007, California. The report states, as it came closer, its shape became more apparent. It looked more like a boomerang, but it was very smooth. The top side was made of what appeared to be a highly reflective gold-colored metal. The bottom of the object was colored of a dull bronze, and it didn't seem to reflect the light. It made absolutely no sound, and it initially moved very slowly, too slow for an airplane to fly. As it approached us, the object banked to the north and after about 30 seconds reversed its direction, revealing its side to us. We watched watched it for some time and moved back and forth, and then all of a sudden it tipped its nose up to about a 45-degree angle and quickly ascended out of sight.
That's some very detailed description right there.
Yeah, this was this is from a MUFON report from 2007, and MUFON reports are typically pretty detailed.
Have you guys ever been on their website and read those accounts?
Yes.
They're very interesting.
Which website?
The MUFON.
Mutual UFO Network.
Yeah. Yep.
There's also the Open Minds website.
I could not find a Wikipedia entry for the boomerang-shaped or the chevron-shaped UFO, so I just kind of went with different sightings of that shape. But as you can see, it's been reported since at least 1972. Seems to be one of the earlier reportings of it in Fort Stockton, Texas, and at least with this collection of reports, the most recent was 2008. So
it's always interesting to see how a certain shape is popular for a certain time period.
Yeah, like the pyramid shape, like we mentioned last week, is now the shape du jour.
Shape du jour, I like that.
Thank you, the shape du jour.
Good job.
Say that fast 5 times.
Shape du jour. See, I messed up on the first time. First time I messed that up.
So, that is our craft corner, the boomerang or chevron-shaped UFO.
All right. Good job, Brad. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all learned something today. Let's move on to our picks. These are things that we watched, read, did, whatever, related to aliens. And it looks like, if I'm reading this right, Anessa is up first.
Yes. I watched a TV show. Woo!
Good job.
And
good job,
it is called Weird or What?
Oh, this is the William Shatner show, right?
Unless you're not from Canada, then the first season does not have William Shatner.
Oh, okay. All right.
So, my version did not have William Shatner, but it's a series on the Discovery Channel and History, I think History up in Canada, and each episode contains... The Wikipedia thing says 3, mine had 4, so 3 or more, separate stories of the bizarre and unexplained. As the show unfolds, it weighs various supernatural and scientific theories that attempt to explain the story, and sometimes features tests conducted as proof of a theory's plausibility. The show features strange occurrences such as ghosts, aliens, monsters, medical oddities, and natural disasters. So the episode that I watched is episode 2 of season 1, and it's called Ghost Ship. And the first story that pops up talks about mysterious lights hovering over a small town in Texas. The town that they hovered over is Stephenville, Texas, which is southwest of Fort Worth by about an hour and a half. But anyway, so basically they talk about how... there were these eyewitness accounts of these lights hovering overhead, and it wasn't just witnessed by one or two people. It was witnessed by, like, a whole bunch of people throughout the town, and the police department ended up with a bunch of phone calls. And I believe, man, I really don't remember. I believe it was 2008, 2009. It's fairly recent. And one of the witnesses was a police officer, and another witness... was a retired Air Force person, and a lot of people believe that it was UFOs, but the theory that I kind of dug the best, because it seemed to be the most plausible, was the Air Force sometimes does these little practice flights, and what they do is they will drop flares, and I guess the purpose of these flares is to basically distract heat-seeking missiles. And they were basically just dropping the flares and doing test flights and whatnot, training maneuvers. And so a lot of people don't agree with this. I think initially the Air Force was like, oh, we weren't doing anything. And then a couple days later, they're like, oh, yeah, we were totally over there. Sorry about that. So, of course, that really sparked up more conspiracy theorists to be like, oh, they're up to shenanigans. But I honestly think that they were just doing their flight testing. So that's just me. The other stories that they talked about was a fishing boat that vanishes without a trace off of the coast of California, only to be found entirely undamaged at the bottom of the ocean months later.
Ooh.
They kind of wondered if maybe there was another Bermuda Triangle type thing going on, because the boat that they're talking about is like the third boat that had disappeared within a year in that area. But the idea for that they had was it could have been a rogue wave, that could have capsized the boat, and the people didn't have enough time to send out a distress signal to call for help. And then there's the bloop. I've heard of this before, but hadn't really heard much more than, oh, there's a sound called the bloop, and nobody knows what caused it. And they talk about the bloop. It's the loudest sound heard in history. It was actually heard, I think, out in the middle of the ocean, and the, I believe it was the U.S. military that had several recording devices, but they were thousands of miles apart, and these devices were about 3,000 miles from where the sound originated, and it picked up the sound, but nobody knows what caused it. So, one theory is that it could have been an animal, but we don't know of what animal could actually create a sound that could generate sound waves for 3,000 miles in the ocean.
Well, maybe one of those huge, maybe one of those huge whales, the blue whales, right? The blues are the
biggest. They talked about that, but no, even that isn't the loudest. And they said if there is a monster that is, or a monster, a creature that is big enough to create a sound that big, then, oh man, we're in for some trouble.
I say kaiju.
It's the kaiju.
Yes.
And the other idea was that it could have just been maybe some testing, people doing nuclear tests out in the middle of the ocean, perhaps.
That's such an interesting topic of
manufacturing kaiju.
Yeah.
Yes. And then the fourth story, a scientist noticed that cows face either north or south. And so they wonder if cows can really sense the Earth's magnetic poles. They tried to create this corral where they would basically have magnetic force at the north and the south, and then they would flip the poles to like the east and west, or flip north with south. But initially, the first couple of tests that they did, the cow is just like, I hate being by myself. I'm going to break out of this corral and go hang out with my cow friends over there. And the last one, I think they put the cattle away or something, so they were out of sight and out of mind for the cow that was in the corral. And whenever they did flip the polarity, the cow did turn, but I think they really need more testing than that one. The guy seemed pretty convinced, like, oh, yeah, they can totally detect the Earth's magnetic poles, but I think there needs to be more testing involved.
The Mythbusters need to do this and need to do the whole dogs using the bathroom standing a certain way. Did you guys hear about that story a couple of years ago?
Yeah, they have to face north or something. They have to face a particular direction whenever they go crap.
Anessa, you could have said, you said
true. Like, if you watch them, they're like, okay, I'm going to sniff, sniff, sniff. Okay, here's the perfect spot. Now I have to turn. Okay, perfect direction. And go.
I'm gonna have to take notes on our dog to see if she does that.
Speaking of dogs, kind of random. I was mowing the lawn, and when I was trying to get the lawnmower to start, I felt like this cold, wet thing against my leg, and I turned around, and it was a dog. I was like, oh, hey, doggy.
Did it startle you a little bit?
Little bit, because I'm like, whoa, what's that? That's not a mosquito.
Interesting.
And I turn around, and it's like this little pit bull. I'm like, oh, you're adorable.
Oh, cool.
And he's like, hey. And then he turned around and ran off.
Ah, okay.
He had tags, but I couldn't get him to come back so I could see where he belonged. Oh,
he was one of those dog aliens, I'm guessing.
Probably.
Yeah.
Like, no messages here. Gotta go. Gotta go mine the Caxian stuff.
All right.
Good. Or no, they're the Caxians. I forget what they're mining. Yep.
Yeah. All right, Anessa, thank you very much. Weird or What was your pick? Moving on to mine. Show called Indians and Aliens. It's a six-part, half-hour documentary TV series which airs on the Aboriginal People's Network, TV network here in Canada. It's basically about the encounters with unidentified flying objects in the Cree territories of northern Quebec. And it's weird that it's so specifically there, because there's a lot of Native people in Canada, as there is in the U.S., and they're very specific. The only thing I can think of is next season they're going to be moving on to, like, I don't know, Winnipeg or Manitoba or, you know, one of the other provinces. So who knows? So this show deals with the unexplained, to the all-too-explainable. Indians and Aliens investigates the growing amount of UFO reports with an aboriginal view of the universe, a mix of science, military history, and spiritual exploration of the unknown. Indians and Aliens investigates credible witness accounts with scientists and other experts in an attempt to open up possible explanations, but there are eyewitness reports that defy rational thought. So if you're listening to us and you're in Canada, or I'm sure you can find this online someplace too, it's called Indians and Aliens. And it's really a good, it's in the vein of any other, like, Ghost Hunters, or what was that show a few years ago with Josh, I forget his last name. They kind of investigated like Bigfoot stuff, or not just ghosts, but a wide variety of like paranormal stuff.
Yeah, I don't remember the name of the show though.
Yeah, it's.
But I know what you're talking about.
It's kind of in that vein. It's done very well. I mean, they have their team of experts. They have one person that is expert in this certain thing, and then somebody else does this certain thing, and they do kind of have a aboriginal native slant to it.
Fact or faked?
No, but that is a similar show as well.
Josh Gates,
yeah. Maybe that was it.
Oh, Destination Truth.
Yeah, that's what it. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
But it's in the vein of all those shows. I mean, they do one case per episode, and they thoroughly investigate it, and they usually find some kind of rational explanation, but sometimes there's not, just like the description said. So, yeah, if you get a chance, I didn't do a search on YouTube. There may be episodes on YouTube, because this seems like the kind of show that might pop up on YouTube. So if you're interested, Indians and Aliens, search for it on YouTube. Maybe you'll be able to find it if you're not in the country of Canada. And it looks like Brad is copying and pasting and going to find out if it's actually available on YouTube. So I'm...
There are trailers.
Okay.
Trying to see if they do. They don't seem to have full episodes there. I was going to see if Netflix or somebody else offers it as well.
Yeah, that could be. It's. I think it debuted last year, so it may be too early to have a show, the episodes on a service like Netflix. But who knows? It's possible. But, if you like those kind of investigation shows, do a little dig and maybe you'll be able to find it.
Yeah, so I don't see it on Hulu or Netflix.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Thank you for searching. Thank you for investigating, sure. Brad. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
But that is my pick. All right. Third pick. Brad, yours. What do you got?
Oh, I've got a real winner here. When I say the name Chase Masterson, what do you think of?
I think of Lita from Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Absolutely. Bruce Campbell, what do you think of?
Army of Darkness, right?
Yes, you are absolutely correct. Now, if I say Jason Jones, what do you think of?
Jason Jones, I have no idea. Anessa, do you know?
My first thought was a TA that we used to have working for the astronomy department.
That may be correct, but not the answer we're looking for.
The Daily Show.
Jason Jones is on The Daily Show.
Oh, I knew that name sounded familiar.
Yeah. Okay. And I found out that Jason Jones is also married to Samantha Bee, who also appears on The Daily Show.
Oh, weird.
Yeah. Anyways, why is this all important? Why did I ask these questions? What common tie do they all have?
They all like pizza.
Pizza's pretty awesome. I would say that that's probably a fair bet. You may be right. I don't have proof, but I'm going to go with a different answer. Thank you. They were in a movie in 2002, so 12 years ago, called Terminal Invasion.
Terminal Invasion.
Yeah. I found this on Netflix, and as I was flipping through, I saw Bruce Campbell, and I'm like, oh, yeah, here we go. It's on. I'm going to give you the brief IMDb rundown here. In a stormy night, while transporting the criminal Jack, played by Bruce Campbell, to the death corridor, he's a going to death row. The officers have a car accident nearby a private airport.
Of course they do.
Bring the prisoner. Sorry?
Of course they do. Why would they not have an accident?
You'd think cops handing, coffee from a thermos cup to each other wouldn't spill it and cause an accident.
No.
But,
Mm-hmm.
You need to move the plot forward. They bring the prisoner to the place where clients, I don't know why they say clients, but there are people at this little tiny private airport are arguing with the owner of the charter services and who is named Kathy Garrett, played by Chase Masterson, because she refuses to take off in the blizzard and the communications are down due to the snowstorm, although that seems a little odd.
Yeah.
Jack asks to go to the toilet while being escorted by the two guards. However, in the bathroom, a preacher attacks and kills the guards, and when Jack kills him, his body vanishes. Jack returns to the lobby, and when the security guard holds him, which is wrong, it's actually the airport, he's like the cleanup dude, he's the guy that goes out and plows the airstrip and whatnot, he accidentally shoots one of the passengers, but the woman that he shot doesn't die until Jack shoots her in the head. At which point, everybody realizes that there's an alien invasion going on, and there are aliens in this airport.
Whoa!
And wackiness ensues.
Hang on, Brad. Hang on one second. I think that deserves some kind of sound effect. Say that last thing that you said. Not the last thing you said. They realize what?
They realize that the airport is invaded by aliens.
Okay, good.
There we go. Hit me with some Inception, yo. A very interesting concept. It was like, imagine They Live done for about $3,000.
$3,000, really?
The story, while not entirely original, had some interesting twists, and there was one particular item that I didn't see coming necessarily because of the structure of the dialogue, how it was written, was a little surprising. Although at a certain point you kind of realize what's going on, but the structure of how this particular item was set up was kind of wonderfully executed, I thought. The characters are all interesting. Not Academy Awarding winning performances, but for a B sci-fi thriller whodunit kind of a movie, not bad at all. Out of 5 stars, I'd probably give it 3.
Really?
Yeah.
That threw me for a loop, Brad. I thought you were gonna say it's terrible. Don't watch it.
No, there's I guess it really depends on the. I really enjoyed watching B horror movies. Yeah, I think we talked about it before. I enjoyed Life Force. I enjoyed Night of the Comet. I enjoyed seeing some really schlocky B sci-fi / horror type films, of which this definitely falls into the category of. It's really interesting too, comparing the time periods of those films that I've mentioned from the 80s to the effects that are available now if you've got Adobe Premiere. you can tell that these effects are computer generated and are, not ILM quality, but passable for the type of film that you're watching. Like I said, it's on Netflix. I give it 3 stars, and it's got Bruce Campbell, so you know what you're in for, and it's kind of an interesting flick.
All right. Cool. I guess they did good with what they had, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, yes. I mean, you can be a bad movie because you were trying too hard, but I think they realized that they're not making a masterpiece, so they probably figured out what their angle was and went for it.
Yeah. It really, for what they were shooting for, what they were trying to accomplish, they accomplished it,
mm-hmm.
and they did it pretty well. They weren't going for Alien. They weren't going for They Live, but they were trying to capture the feel of that without having the budget for it. So,
okay.
Yeah, all in all, not a bad flick.
All right. So in review, our picks this week were Terminal Invasion. We had Indians and Aliens and Weird or What. And you can check out our picks on the show notes that go along with this podcast or on the website galacticnetcasts.com. Okay, final bit of business here. Don't forget you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. And don't forget to subscribe to us either on iTunes or Stitcher. If you go on the iTunes route, please give us 5 stars and a good review because that gets us more subscribers. Another way we get more subscribers is word of mouth. You tell your friends, you tell your neighbors, you tell your family that this great podcast called the Alien Invasion Podcast. You should totally listen because it's not just for sci-fi geeks. They talk about all kinds of cool stuff. So word of mouth, subscribe, and that's it. Any final thoughts, guys, before we get out of here?
We're going to go see Edge of Tomorrow tomorrow.
I hear tomorrow. Nothing but good things about that movie. I've not seen a single negative bad review of that film.
Yeah, I've actually heard good things, so I'm excited.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. You know, I do want to, and granted, we're going, if people have been paying attention to the movie draft that we did in our other show, the Sci-Fi Geeks Club, there were 6 of us, essentially, 4 from the Galactic Netcasts team and 2 guys from What We're Watching Weekly, and we all did a movie draft where we picked summer films, not just limited to sci-fi, but summer movies from starting from the release of Captain America Winter Soldier, so mid-May, to Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which will be coming out at the end of August. So it's been kind of interesting watching our progression based on the films that we've purchased, or purchased with points that we set up. It was a point buy for each movie. And one of the bigger movies I think that we thought we had this summer, which was Edge of Tomorrow. That's one of the reasons why we want to go see it, is, and that's an iron on a team, and that was one of our films that we wanted to get.
You're gonna have to
in our stable.
The movie needs as many admissions as it can to win, because it lost last week. It premiered the same weekend as Fault in Our Stars. That movie did great.
Yes.
Edge Tomorrow, not so much. So maybe the second week they'll come back and get some asses in the seat.
I still think Captain America was too early for a summer movie. I mean, that was April, beginning of April. I just thought summer movie started in May.
Yeah, but it was that starts earlier every year, and I think it was it's considered a summer blockbuster type movie.
So,
all right,
April 4th, that's early.
I have a final thought, guys. Can I do a final thought?
Get out of town.
Heck yeah.
If you want another podcast to listen to, I highly recommend you check out the Sleeping with the Elephant podcast, Sleeping with the Elephant podcast with Paul Swickard, Anessa and I's former host on the Time Traveling Robots in Space. I was on their podcast this week, so hopefully think they'll be coming out this week. So subscribe to it and take a listen to the episode I was on. It was fun.
Sweet.
Paul and a guy named Ryan Murphy. He's actually the concept of the show is Ryan's from Canada, Paul's from the U.S., and they talk about the differences. And it was kind of neat for me to be on there because I've seen both sides. I've lived in both places, so we kind of walk through my transition into the culture of Canada, that kind of thing. So take a listen, subscribe even, and tell them that we sent you. All right, that's going to do it. Hey, thanks for listening this week, guys, and we'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
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 Leave your hailing frequencies open and scanners on full, because another Galactic Netcast will be approaching your coordinates soon. For more information, go to galacticnetcasts.com.